Francis, even. It had been so long since she had seen Francis. There had been a strange compulsion in her to go back and study her, work out why she had been cast off by her and given to Valerie. Maybe she had been looking for redemption, though she should have known she would never get it from Francis. When she had arrived at the house and Francis had been purging the place, there had been no acknowledgement of the albatross around Rachel's neck. Francis had just greeted her as a feckless younger sister who needed to share the load. Then other things had taken over, had muddied the waters, had led them to this. A point where for anything to change, the truth had to be told. The door swung open. "Look at this. Let's put the lights on, shall we? We don't want you lying here all on your own in the dark, do we?" the nurse said, flicking the light switch and forcing Rachel to screw up her eyes against the sudden intrusion of light. "Just come to do your checks," the nurse added, wrapping a tight cuff around Rachel's arm and sticking an electronic thermometer into her ear. The cuff on her arm began to inflate, to the point where it was causing her more discomfort than the injuries. "That all seems fine." "What happened to the police? Are they still here?" "Oh, no, love, they're long gone. Hasn't anyone been in to tell you?" Rachel shook her head. "Oh, right. Well, never mind. No, they went after they'd spoken to Mr. Parnell, her neurologist." "What did they say to him? What did he tell them?" "Well, from what I can gather, he seems to think you might have done this to yourself. He spoke to the surgeon who patched up your leg, and he seems to agree that it didn't look like the kind of thing someone else might have done to you. It looked to him like you'd managed to lacerate yourself during one of your seizures." Rachel gave a huge sigh of relief. "Did the police believe him?" "I don't know. Must have done, I suppose. They haven't been back, anyway."
"So, what happens now?"
"Well, Mr. Parnell has completely reviewed your medication, and we are trying you on a new regime. You'll be allowed home as soon as we know it's working and you're up and around on that leg. Did yourself quite a bit of damage there?"
"It must have been the broken plate. When the seizure started, I had it in my hand. I must have gone down and managed to ram it into my leg," Rachel mused.
The nurse paused what she was doing and looked down at her. "Look, I know it's not my place to say, and I'm not saying that their explanation isn't possible, but I've seen the marks on your back, and you've got bruises, old ones and new ones. If you are in a violent relationship, there are always ways of getting out. I'll bring you some leaflets, pop them in your bedside drawer. You can have a read and give it some thought, eh?" she said, patting Rachel's hand. Why was it that people thought the cruel ones were always men? The scars on her back had healed a long time ago, as would the one on her leg. The wounds in her mind had never healed, and no man had caused them. There were so many hospitals in London. Amy had almost used up her minutes for that month ringing hospitals to find out where Rachel had been admitted. After she had finally managed to track her down, she felt mildly stupid when realizing that St. Mary's was only a stone's throw away. Outside Rachel's room, she hesitated, unsure of what she would find when she went inside. She had an ominous sense that she could be about to make a bad day considerably worse. There was hardly a clearly defined etiquette for visiting your injured, estranged mother. Bracing herself, she pushed open the door, walked in and regarded the woman who was propped up in the bed with her eyes closed. How could everybody manage to sleep through this horrendous situation? "This is my mother. This hollowed-out, fragile, injured woman is my mother." There was something about hospital beds, drips, and machines with displays and alarms that had the effect of reducing people to a shadow of their real selves. It was something Amy had noticed during her nurse training. Illness and dependency diminished people. The woman in the bed was just that, an older, diminished version of herself. Looking at Rachel's careworn face, she realized how few of her father's features her own face held. People had often said that she must look like her mother, but until now she'd only had a few old photographs for comparison. To be confronted with this faded version of herself was a shock. "I am not like you," she told herself. "I would never walk away from my child." Rachel was aware of another presence in the room. She could smell perfume, so knew it wasn't a nurse. Whoever was there wasn't moving, but she could feel their eyes on her, sense the appraisal. She opened her eyes and turned her head towards the visitor. "Amy," the girl looked surprised. "You know who I am?" At a disadvantage, Rachel tried to prop herself up further, but her left hand was hampered by the drip. "Of course," she said breathlessly, finally managing to find purchase on the crisp sheets by using her elbows. She knew that this might happen one day.
On good days, she had fantasized about it, a wonderful reunion where the past had no meaning. On most days, the bad days, she had dreaded it.
"They told me you were dead," Amy said,
still standing, her bag held in front of her like a shield, as if Rachel might leap out of the bed and do something untoward.
"I know. They arrested my dad today. They thought he attacked you."
"Yes, that the police came. He didn't do anything. Is he all right?"
"Like you care."
Rachel looked down at her bandaged hands, at the tube that was still slowly dripping blood back into her body. It was hard to imagine why people would go to such lengths to keep her alive. If she were a dog, they would have let her die.
"They let him go," Amy said finally. "I went to your flat. Someone found your bracelet. I found out you were still alive and I went to your flat."
Rachel closed her eyes, trying to imagine what her home must look like to someone like Amy, an ordinary girl with a normal life. "It was my aunt's flat."
"What kind of person lives like that? Surrounded by all that junk," Amy said spitefully.
"Does it matter how I live?"
"It explains a lot. Tells me what kind of person you are. It tells me you don't care."
"Care about what? Who I am, where I live, how I live?" "I don't," Rachel thought. But she couldn't say that. She owed this child, her child, more. "I never got around to changing it," she said, knowing that it sounded lame. Amy moved to the end of the bed, braver now that she knew Rachel wasn't going to fight back.
"Why did you come back? If you hadn't come back, none of this would have happened," she said, gripping the bed rail, her knuckles white.
"My mother died. There were things to sort out. I'm sorry, I never meant you to find out about me like this." Rachel saw the girl's emotions shift a little, thrown off by the revelation of a death.
"Well, I'm sorry about your mum."
"Don't be. No one else is. She wasn't much of a mother. It seems to be a family trait," Rachel said with a wry laugh. Amy looked defeated, as if she had expected something quite different to this. She looked incredibly sad, and it tore at Rachel's already bruised heart. There was a chair by the bed. Amy dragged herself over to it and flopped down.
"I don't know why I'm here. I don't know what I expected to find. I want to hate you, but look at you lying there, looking like you've been hit by a truck. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel."
Rachel regarded her daughter and denied herself the rush of regret that would threaten them both, Amy most of all.
"You want to know why I left?
Well, this is why," she said, indicating her battered body. "Last night I had a seizure. I had a piece of broken china in my hand. I managed to mutilate my own leg, and I didn't have any control over it. Imagine someone capable of that in charge of a baby. What might have happened to you if I'd stayed?" Amy shook her head.
"No, that's not it. You had help. My grand, dad, they would have helped you." "No, it's more than that."
Rachel plucked at the cotton blanket, ignoring the discomfort in her hand from the big needle that insistently dripped life into her veins.
"It's hard to explain because I don't know how much you know about your dad's past." "If you mean that he was in prison for bumping off his first wife, yeah, I know,"
Amy said dryly.
"Right, well, what you might not know, because he doesn't talk about it, or didn't used to, was that I was there when Patsy was found. I saw what happened, and I know your dad didn't do it."
"So why did he go to prison then?" Amy demanded, looking surprised that the subject had got in this direction. Rachel sighed. "It's complicated. I was only 10 when it happened. I was a kid who had fits and no one believed me. See, your dad had the knife in his hand. I was the one who had witnessed him find Patsy like that. She had been having an affair with my sister's husband, so he had a motive. Lots of people gave evidence against him, my family included."
"Look, I know he was innocent. Anyone who actually knows him would say the same."
"I know, but that's not what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to explain the background. We got together not long after he came out. I suppose we gravitated towards each other, like we were the only friendly faces each other could see. I'd stayed in touch with your gran, and she was a good friend. My family aren't decent people."
"Yeah, I gathered. I read the papers."
"Quite. Anyway, I was lonely and unhappy. So was your dad, so we just drifted together for the wrong reasons. I doubt it would ever have worked, and for the reasons I've given you, I couldn't take you with me. I thought the only option I had was to leave, for good, and give you all a chance of a decent life. My family would never have left us alone. It's difficult for me to explain to you what they were like, but they knew I had been left some money, and they would never have left us alone until they got hold of it. I'm not saying I did the right thing, but I did what I thought was right at the time, Rachel explained. Knowing that elements of it were true, but as an explanation, it was so full of holes it could give a colander a run for its money. At best, it would leave Amy despising her, but not asking her to say any more. So you came into money and buggered off, leaving your family behind, and you want me to believe it was a noble gesture, Amy said, already on her feet. I don't know why I came here. I wish I could just wipe out the last few days and have gone on thinking you were dead. Well, I hope you enjoyed your freedom, because I can tell you now that none of us have. My dad never got over you leaving us, never. He doesn't trust anyone anymore, not even me now, because of you. You did that to him. She was shouting now. Rachel looked towards the door, afraid that the staff would hear. So thanks a lot, you selfish cow. Take a good look before I go, because you won't be setting eyes on any of us again. I promise you that, Amy yelled, barging towards the door and pushing past an astonished nurse who had come to see what the problem was. What was all that about? Are you all right? The nurse asked, peering down the corridor to observe the girl's hasty flight. I'm okay. It's okay. She's just a bit overwrought, that's all, Rachel said, still shaking and desperately trying to hang on to her senses. The nurse fussed with her bedding and pulled up her pillows. You're telling me? We could hear the shouting at the other end of the ward. Are you sure you're all right? Rachel nodded. Just tired. The nurse frowned. Okay, well, we'll be round with the medication in a minute. I'll get someone to bring you a cup of tea, too, then you can get some rest. Rachel gave her a weak smile and sank back onto her pillows. It was all for the best, really. Better that Amy despise her than know the truth. Even so, it had been harder to do than she had thought. One of the hardest, other than walking away in the first place. If she could get out of the damn bed, she would do that now, walk away. Make her way down to the embankment, stand on a bridge, and contemplate throwing herself into the Thames. It had been a favourite pastime over the years. Blackfriars Bridge at 5 a.m. always being the favourite. But the fact that Amy already thought she was dead had always stopped her. That, and the thought of the poor person who would find her body. The same with the underground, an overdose, hanging, all of it. She had weighed the option so many times. Someone would always have to suffer for her actions. There had never been an easy way out. Chapter 20. Charlie was roused from a deep, deep sleep by the screeching insistence of an alarm he hadn't set. For a moment he had forgotten where he was, the sight of the unfamiliar surroundings catching him off guard and bringing him instantly upright on the bed and instinctively alert. Irritated, he fumbled with the alarm in a vain attempt to switch it off, eventually resorting to pulling the plug out of the wall. Though his brain told him he was awake, his body didn't seem to want to follow suit. Still exhausted, he rubbed his face and looked around the room. His mind was telling him that something important was missing. He fumbled in his thoughts for what it could be. Amy. Energized by an abrupt shot of anger, he leapt to his feet, looking for his shoes. Only when he went to retrieve his jacket did he see her note. Oh, for God's sake, he said out loud, dropping back onto the bed. Then, fuck, the bloody van. What was it with kids that they could never just do what they were told? Why did they always think that they could go one better with their insatiable need for instant gratification? He was still champing on his temper when he reached the van, figuring he had better move it before it was clamped or towed away. While fumbling for his keys, he realized that he was being watched. Someone was peering at him from behind a net curtain in the flat below Rachel's. He could hear a dog frantically barking from somewhere inside. He gave the voyeur a one smile and a half-hearted wave. Immediately, the curtain was dropped and the face disappeared. Shrugging, he got into the van and drove it around the block until he found an empty parking space. Then he went back to the flats and rang the doorbell. Anyone else who owned a building in London would have had some kind of security system fitted, but not Rachel. The front door was solid, but anyone could have got in if they'd had half a mind to. Besides, both he and Amy had been able to walk into the flat that morning. Not even the police had thought to release the latch on Rachel's front door. He rang the bell again and saw a dim light through the glass. Someone was coming, but they didn't open the door.
If you do not leave immediately, I will have no choice but to telephone the police, came a tremulous yet imperious voice from behind the door.
Please, I need to speak with you about... What happened?
I need to explain,
he called loudly, both to penetrate the glass of the door and to rise above the persistent yapping of the dog.
Please leave immediately,
the woman shrieked.
Dad, what are you doing?
Amy was at the bottom of the steps, peering up at him. He gave up on trying to persuade the woman to let him in. He was getting nowhere.
I was trying to get her to let me in. Someone needs to clear up that mess upstairs.
Amy looked aghast.
You're what? I don't believe you. After all that woman's done, you want to go in and clean her kitchen.
Charlie reached the bottom of the steps and sighed.
You don't understand. There isn't anyone else to do it, and I can't let her come back to that, he said. Oh, my God, you're honestly telling me that after everything, you still care about her. Are you mad?
Amy said, incredulity written all over her face. Charlie felt his anger flare again.
Don't you dare speak to me like that. You don't have a clue about what's going on, so don't even pretend to have a valid opinion on my actions.
Amy blinked in surprise. He hardly ever raised his voice to her.
She pretended to be dead. You lied to me, and now you don't think I have a right to be upset.
Charlie's anger fizzled out like a cheap indoor firework.
Okay, okay. I think we both need to calm down a bit. I know you need an explanation. We need to talk. But I need some food first. I'm absolutely bloody starving, and it's making me irritable.
There's a Burger King round the corner. We could get takeaway. Go back to the room.
That's the best thing I've heard all day. Come on, but you'll have to pay. I put the last of my money in the parking meter, he said,
finally relenting and putting his arm around her shoulder.
No problem, I'm loaded. I nicked your stash from under the sink.
I know. You're not supposed to know about that.
Anyway, what the hell are you doing wandering around London with that kind of money on you? Anything could have happened.
Christ, Dad, look at the state of me. Any would-be mugger would probably take pity on me, not rob me.
They were at the door of the burger bar.
What are you having, the usual?
They took their food back to the room, past the suspicious gaze of the hotel receptionist, and ate it sitting on the bed. Charlie propped against the headboard, Amy sitting cross-legged at his feet.
Why does crap food always taste so nice?
She asked, cramming the last mouthful of burger into her mouth, mayonnaise dribbling down her chin.
Because you've had to survive my cooking for 20 years.
It was true. At best, his culinary style could be described as rustic.
Was she a good cook?
Amy asked.
It was a good inn, he thought. They needed to get to the subject of Rachel sooner or later.
He laughed.
Rachel? Cook? She was abysmal. She could burn water.
Amy tried to smile, but it wouldn't happen.
I saw her earlier. I went to the hospital.
Charlie nodded.
I got your note. What did she say to you?
That she couldn't cope, that you and her would never have lasted because you were together for all the wrong reasons.
Charlie frowned and nodded slowly. We didn't deliberately lie to you about her. It was just an untruth that was more convenient than it ought to have been. I'm sorry, I should never let it go on so long.
I get it. It's okay. Better than growing up knowing your own mother didn't want you, I guess.
He raised his eyebrows. If that's what she told you, she was lying.
What else could it be? Yeah, sure, I know the story, the epilepsy and all, but if she loved us at all, she would have stayed. I mean, life wasn't easy for you, but you didn't bail out on me when it got tough.
You're wrong. She left because she did love us, believe me. You don't know her. She would never have gone if she hadn't had a really good reason to think it was for the best.
He didn't want to tell her the truth, but he couldn't see another way. If he lied, she would hate Rachel forever, and that wasn't fair. If he told the truth, he would open up a whole new wound full of confusion and hurt. Lies had brought them to this. The truth might hurt, but at least there was a chance.
What possible excuse could anyone have for doing something so selfish? Amy asked, her tone heavy with derision.
Charlie exhaled slowly and leaned forward.
A pretty good one, as it happens. And I only found out about it myself this morning, so don't fly off the handle with me and think I've been keeping things from you again. It's kind of hard for me to tell you this because there is a lot of history behind it, but bear with me, okay?
He told her what Delia had told him that morning, and watched as a melee of emotions clashed on her face, twisting her features into 100 kinds of shock.
Oh my God! That's disgusting! No, it's worse than that. I can't find a word for it. It's evil!
She was tumbling over her reactions and stumbling over her words.
How? Why would anyone do that? Lie about something so awful? What was wrong with that woman that she would say something so vile? No wonder she went back after the bitch died. Probably checking that the coffin lid was nailed shut just in case.
She gasped as the true horror of what she'd been told started to take hold.
That's just sick. It's twisted. It's foul.
Well, given what they've just found in the house, it's not surprising. Even I didn't think Valerie Porter was capable of something like that, and I've seen her at her worst, Charlie said, unsure of whether he had his own mind around the implications of it.
Dad, don't take this the wrong way, but it's not true, is it?
No, it's not true, I swear. But doesn't it give you some idea of how fragile she was that she believed it? Rachel had been kicked when she was down, was still being kicked now. Amy put her hand to her mouth.
Oh, Dad, I was really, really horrible to her today. Really spiteful.
A sob caught in her throat. Charlie reached out and patted her knee. It'll be okay. She can handle awful, she's used to it. It's nice she can't handle.
She told me that you two only got together because of circumstances. Is that true?
No, I don't think so. Not for me, anyway. I loved her. I still do. I always have, and I probably always will. Whatever else happened, you came out of it, and I wouldn't change that for anything.
God, Dad, don't go soppy on me. I'm really trying not to cry here.
Charlie ruffled her hair, and she batted him away.
Seriously, though, you have to tell her the truth. You can't let her go on believing that filth. Christ, if it'd be me, I think I'd have topped myself.
He shook his head. Not Rachel. She would think it was selfish to do that. No, she will have just sucked it up and carried it on her own. Though his tone was casual, the pain of his statement was so acute it sent an agonizing tremor of stress right through his heart. So much so it skipped a beat or two.
That flat. The way she lives, it's as if she's an intruder in someone else's life. At first I just thought she had tacky taste, but like grand, but it's not that, is it?
Charlie had to smile at the insult to Delia. No, it's not that. She has money, in fact she's loaded. I think that's the reason Valerie did what she did. I think she never changed the flat, never made it her own home, because without you it meant nothing to her. Home is where the heart is, and her heart was always with you. I think it's why I kept going back, trying to make sense of what she'd done. I could understand why she left me, but never why she left you. Okay, I've heard the epilepsy excuse a million times, but I never bought it. I mean, we could have paid someone to help care for you. It's never made sense. Amy nodded in agreement.
And it would have meant contact with you. Under the circumstances, I suppose she couldn't risk that. I think she really loved you. Oh, God, her life must have been absolute hell.
Tears filled her eyes.
Oh, Dad, I don't think I've ever felt so sad in my life.
She began to cry. Charlie eased himself towards her and started to rub her back. She was right. He had never felt so sad either. But he would mend it. The very next day he would mend it once and for all. Chapter 21 Lucille Barnes-Harmon had had enough. If that man persisted on ringing her doorbell one more time, she would take a stick to him herself. Just because the police couldn't be bothered to deal with his type effectively didn't mean that elderly women should be terrorized in their own homes. She would tell him one more time, and that was that. If he carried on, the worm would turn. She marched resolutely towards the front door, clutching in her trembling hand a large marble rolling pin, the nearest thing to a stick she'd been able to find. Miffy gambolled excitedly at her heels, eager for action.
"I've told you before, go away. I have to warn you, the police are on their way, and I am armed."
She called down the hallway, brandishing the rolling pin in a wild act of bravado.
"Miss Barnes-Harmon, it's me, Rachel. Can you let me in, please? I don't have my keys."
Lucille stared at the door in disbelief. It couldn't be. Rachel had been carried out on a stretcher. There had been too much blood. It was impossible that she had recovered enough to be allowed home. In fact, Lucille was having a hard time coming to terms with the reality that Rachel had survived her ordeal at all. Typical of the NHS, sending people home who were barely alive. She had always favoured private medicine. A much more civilised system, in her opinion. Though it was true of all life, really. You only ever got what you paid for. Fortunately, she had always functioned with the best of health and some good British stoicism. That and a fundamental mistrust of men who were far too handsome for anybody's good, like the one who had attacked Miss Porter. The doorbell rang again.
Are you there? Please open the door. I really don't feel too good. Miss Barnes-Harmon?
Shaken from her reverie by the fragile tone in Rachel's voice, Lucille plonked the rolling pin on the hall table and made for the door, and was shocked at what she found when she opened it. Rachel was leaning against the wall of the porch, her face drained of colour, her hair stuck to her face by the glaze of sweat that clung to her pallid skin. Instinctively, Lucille put out her arm to help the girl inside. Rachel clung to her gratefully, and hauled herself through the door. She was limping badly.
"Good grief, Miss Porter! Look at you, I can't believe they've allowed you to come home in this state!"
Lucille was genuinely shocked. Rachel was wearing a blood-stained T-shirt, the same one she had been wearing when Lucille had found her, and a pair of blue cotton trousers, the kind that surgeons wore. Both her hands sported dressings, and on her feet she wore only slippers. She looked like death warmed up.
"Oh, I'm fine, just a bit sore.
They needed the bed, you know how it is," Rachel lied. In fact, she had just had an unholy row with the on-call doctor, who had point-blank refused to agree to discharge her. In the end, she had threatened to walk out wearing nothing else but her hospital gown. The doctor had grudgingly relented and had signed a prescription for her medication, telling the nurse in charge to give her some clothes to wear. He had made her sign a detailed disclaimer, absolving the hospital of all responsibility for her welfare. The A&E staff had cut off her trousers, but fortunately there was still a £20 note in the pocket, a little blood-stained but still legal tender. The cabbie had been happy to take it when he realised that he was going to get to keep the change. He hadn't helped get her out of the cab, though, and had just driven off, leaving her to haul herself painfully up the steps to her house. Despite her gung-ho attitude in the hospital, she really did feel like death.
"I'm sorry to have disturbed you, but I didn't have my keys," she said wanly, trying to reassure the frightened old lady.
"My dear child, let me get you inside properly," she said,
supporting Rachel's weight on her thin shoulders and half-carrying her to the stairs, muttering all the while about gross neglect and abject negligence. She wanted to help Rachel into the flat, but Rachel refused, insisting that she would be all right. Both stoically ignored the rust-brown blood that still stained the floor, though Miffy sniffed at it and licked it with unreserved interest. Rachel thanked Lucille profusely for her help, and remained clinging to the doorframe until she heard the door to the downstairs flat click shut. Once alone, she hobbled into the flat, just about ready to pass out. They had given her painkillers and stronger anticonvulsants, and she needed to take both. Unable to face the mess in the kitchen, she hauled herself into the bathroom and took the drugs with handfuls of water from the cold tap, clinging all the while to the edge of the basin for support. Unable to move another step, she sank down onto the toilet, straightening out her injured leg, which was stiff and swollen, the sutures pulling painfully with every movement. Only then did she dare to breathe and let her mask slip, allowing her face to crumple into a contorted agony as her desperate tears began to flow. When the tablets kicked in, she would pack a bag. Now that Amy had been and she was exposed, she had no choice but to leave. She didn't have a clue where she would go. One of the other flats, perhaps? Lila had owned quite a few. She was sure that one or two would be empty. She'd have to call her solicitor and find out who he was using as an agent these days. In the meantime, there was always the hotel option, one with a huge walk-in shower, preferably, where she could wash away the tide of guilt that was threatening to make her smash her head into the bathroom tiles with the next wave. Angie woke her boss and presented him with a cup of coffee. She was already washed and dressed, having spent a sleepless night spent wondering what the hell she was doing, getting her boss drunk and letting him spend the night on her sofa. It was dangerous ground, and she knew it. At the station, it was common knowledge that his marriage was a farce. Angie had never met his wife, but he had heard on the grapevine that the woman was a harridan. But it wasn't an excuse for letting him stay. Not that there was anything in it other than a bit of mutual liking, but it wouldn't look good if anyone at work found out. The thing was, she did like him. He was a decent bloke and a good copper, even if he was a bit burnt out. This case had taken it out of them both. Stella Baxter's interview had run like a bad film plot. Wicked stepmothers, incest, insanity, the lot. It left them with the possibility that they wouldn't get a prosecution based on the suspect's blatant instability. To be honest, she would be glad when the whole thing was done and dusted. Then they could go back to dealing with normal felons, the type who didn't sleep with their fathers and hoard mummified corpses. There's a new toothbrush in the cupboard in the bathroom and some razors and shaving gel on the shelf.
That's if you don't mind smelling of mountain flowers instead of Old Spice, she called from the kitchen, determined to avoid seeing Ratcliffe in his underpants.
Once she heard him unzip the sleeping bag and stumble up the stairs, she went into the lounge and removed all traces of his presence, folding up the bedding, throwing out the beer bottles, spraying the room with air freshener. No evidence here, she thought quietly, as she heard him empty the sink and flush the toilet. They drove in together, but Ratcliffe dropped her off a street away from the station, just so they could arrive at the office separately. The cold light of day had filtered some sense into him, too. There was a message on her desk from the hospital. Frances Haynes was fully conscious. Also, a message from the Met. Charlie Jones had been arrested the day before for a suspected attack on Rachel Porter. She was in hospital, and he had been released without charge. Angie showed Ratcliffe the messages, adding, "What the hell is it with these people?" Ratcliffe had said nothing. He was too busy trying to get an extension on the length of time they could hold Stella Baxter without charge, and he was trying to get a psych report done on her. In the meantime, he told Angie to grab one of the other officers and get down to the hospital to get a statement from Frances Haynes. Angie took one look at Frances, propped up regally in her hospital bed, and decided that she didn't like her. There was something gratingly theatrical in the woman's pose that smacked of someone milking their disadvantaged position to the max. As Angie sat down, Frances gamely struggled up on her pillows and asked her for a glass of water, which she grudgingly poured and waited patiently for her to drink, watching with mounting irritation as the woman fell back onto her pillows with a wan sigh and said, "I'm not sure how much I'll be able to tell you. It's all such a blur." "We just need a statement of what happened on that day," Angie repeated, reluctant to engage in whatever game Frances Haynes wanted her to play. The woman gave a stifled sob, holding her hand over her mouth and waving her apology at Angie. Angie and the other officer exchanged glances. "I'm sorry, it's all just so terribly upsetting, but I'll do my best. Right, here goes," she said, taking an exaggerated breath. "I was at my former family home, clearing it after my mother's recent death. My sister, Rachel, was inside the house, and I was outside with one of the men I had employed to help. Having done the bulk of the work in the house, I decided to tackle the outbuildings. I knew it was going to be a long job, as no one had been in them for years. I went in first and started to hand things out to the man. Eventually, I uncovered a large tin trunk. Assuming that it was full of old junk, I asked my helper to pull it out and assist me to open it. We were surprised to find that it was extremely heavy. It's difficult to recall what happened next. It's still all quite a blur, I'm afraid, but I know we managed to get the lid up. All I can remember is seeing a hand, a human hand. I think it was then that I must have staggered backwards and hit my head on the door. That's it. That's all I remember," she said with an apologetic smile. Angie waited until her colleague had finished writing and handed over the paperwork, and then she read Frances's words back to her, asked her to read it, and then asked her if it was an accurate account of the events on that day. Frances agreed that it was, and put her signature to the page. "Is that all?" she asked. "Yes, thank you," Angie said, getting to her feet. "We'll be in touch if there's anything else we need from you. I'm sure we'll have more questions." "Well, that's all there is to tell, I'm afraid. My husband tells me you found Stella. How is she?" Frances said, a pained expression on her face. "Mrs. Baxter is currently helping us with our inquiries," Angie said, a little more curtly than perhaps she should have. "But how is she pairing up? She's never been a terribly capable sort, if you know what I mean. I must admit I find it hard to believe my own sister capable of such a thing," she said, stifling another sob. "I'm afraid I'm unable to discuss the details of the case at this stage. We'll be in touch, Mrs. Haynes." With that, she turned to leave, not even bothering to say goodbye. Back in the car, she turned to her colleague. "What did you make of that, then?" He shrugged. "Not for me to speculate, really, but I reckon it was worth at least a BAFTA, if not an Oscar." "Yeah, that's exactly what I thought, too," Angie said, wondering how a woman who had been in a coma for 3 days could have rehearsed a statement so thoroughly, when the subject of her account had been the discovery of her deceased brother-in-law, crudely mummified in a tin trunk. Back at the office, she compared Frances's statement with the one taken from the workman Steve Budd on the day the bodies had been discovered. They tied up, except for the fact that Steve had reported that Frances had called out the word Roy when the trunk had been opened, just before she had knocked herself senseless. What D.C. Angie Watson wanted to know was how Frances could have identified her brother-in-law from the mere sight of a mummified hand. The finding of an intact wallet in the presence of a gold canine tooth had identified Roy Baxter's body. From the glimpse that Angie got of his remains, the only thing she could have identified him on that day would have been a man-sized piece of beef jerky. Where was Ratcliffe? They needed to talk. Ratcliffe was once again standing in Julia Ferris's office, hovering in the doorway as usual, ever reluctant to venture into the domain of the dead. "You wanted to see me?" Julia peered at him over her glasses and treated him to an amused smile. "I did indeed. I have some interesting news for you." She picked up a small plastic jar and swirled the contents. Ratcliffe could see something unpleasant floating in the liquid. No doubt it was some body part that had been pickled by Dr. Death. His face betraying his revulsion, he asked, "What is it?" Julia smiled, looking at the sample fondly. "It's a piece of skin. Well, scalp, actually. I recovered it from the shed door at the Limes. It's from Frances Haynes." Ratcliffe was nonplussed. "And?" She looked as if she was savouring the moment. Making him come down and look at things that revolted him was one of her favourite pastimes. He was sure that it amused her to see him squirm. At a guess, he'd say it was because she'd found out his nickname for her and was enjoying the punishment. "I tested it. The DNA matches with the hair that was found on Baxter, gene for gene, so to speak," she said, waiting for him to react. "I only ran the test for the sake of being thorough. After all, we were looking for Stella Baxter's DNA, but I run her sample and there is no match." Ratcliffe's face fell. "Methinks you have the wrong sister," Ferris said. Ratcliffe's mind was processing 19 to the dozen, but like every good computer, he was able to convert it to a background activity. "What about the baby? Does Stella's DNA check out with that?" Julia shook her head. "Not able to get a sample, he was too far gone. There's not a lot on a baby that would withstand the process he was exposed to, or would last that length of time. But I ran Rachel's sample against Stella's, and there is a match. It's not complete, though, and to be honest, it's a bit confusing." "It proves they're related, but not that Stella is Rachel's mother. So my guess is she could be telling the truth about the baby, but there's no way of proving it, I'm afraid."
"And what about the father?"
"Do you have any idea how much all these tests cost, Ratcliffe? Or more to the point, do you care? Well, Benton does, and she's after your hide for all this. But in answer to your question, William Porter is Stella's father, but is not Rachel's. I took the liberty of requesting Stella's biological mother's medical records. She didn't die of TB, she died of syphilis. By the way, I've not met Stella Baxter, and I only have her DNA on a slide, not a blood sample. Tell me, is there anything odd about her eyes and the way she moves?" Now he came to think about it, Ratcliffe supposed there was.
"Well, she kind of shuffles around a bit, like her joints are stiff, and she squints a bit, but I'd put it down to probably needing glasses. Why?"
"She could have syphilis too, but I'd need to do other tests to be sure."
"She's 56 years old. Surely it would have come to light by now."
Julia shook her head. "Not necessarily. She could have inherited a latent tertiary form of the disease from her mother, which can take up to 50 years to manifest symptoms. If her joints and her eyes are affected, my opinion would be that it has been slowly taking over for some time now.
Are there any personality changes?" "I don't know about changes, but she's fucking barking, if that's any help."
"Not really, it's a rather subjective view, Ratcliffe," Julia said scornfully.
"Surely Porter would have it too, so how come he's not being treated for it?"
"Well, I pulled his records too, just to square the circle. He was a street drinker, I believe, and there is a rather tenuous diagnosis of Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Put it this way, I would stake a bit of money on the fact that it's not WKS at all, but the late stages of latent syphilis."
"But surely the unit would have tested for that, and his own doctor would have found it."
Julia sighed. "He's an old man in an underfunded psych unit. They don't run tests unless they have to. All they ever did was a blood count, which showed him to be nutritionally deficient, which is consistent with chronic alcoholism, and liver function tests, which show cirrhosis. All typical. You only look for a disease if you suspect it's there.
The WKS diagnosis didn't come about through clinical evidence, merely by a psych speculation based on the history in the presentation. You'd do well to remember that everything comes down to budgets, Ratcliffe. Joking apart, he'd figured that the Porter clan were rotten to the core. Now he had proof. "And they seemed such a nice family," he quipped. "What about Rachel Porter? What's her clap status?" Julia shook her head in despair. "You're getting your STDs in a twist. The clap is gonorrhea. I think it's the pox that you are so ineptly alluding to. As for Rachel, I don't know. It's unlikely because, despite Stella's claims, there's not enough evidence to suggest that they're mother and daughter." Ratcliffe noticed that she was still holding the jar that contained a piece of Francis Haynes' scalp, waving it around as she spoke. There was no doubt about it. Julia Ferris profoundly unnerved him. So if Stella or Valerie weren't Rachel's mother, who was? "Well, I'm sure you've got better things to do than get a lecture in sexual health and semantics from me," Ferris said, turning to her desk and starting to rifle through the mound of files and papers that were strewn there. Summarily dismissed, Ratcliffe made his way back to the office. He needed to get Angie and go and see Francis Haynes, but most of all he needed to stay out of Benton's way until the case was resolved. He barreled into Angie just as she turned the same corner from the opposite direction, knocking the file she was carrying out of her hand. "Been looking for you," he said breathlessly as she scrabbled on the floor to retrieve the contents of the file. "Funny you should say that," she said, looking unamused by the fact that he just stood there watching as she grovelled on the floor. By the time he'd cottoned on, she'd picked everything up. "Yeah, been to see Ferris," he explained what Ferris had told him. "Funny you should say that," she repeated, handing him the file he had made her drop. "Her statement doesn't add up. She knew it was Baxter in the trunk, but at that point only his hand was showing." "Right, I think we need to go and see her, don't you? Do we need a warrant?" "Probably, but that would involve Benton," he said pensively. "Oh, yeah, I meant to tell you. She's on the warpath." For a moment, Ratcliffe toyed with the idea of arresting Francis without a warrant so that he could avoid his boss. However, that move could have implications. He had no doubt that her snide husband would have a lawyer in there quicker than he could blink. He had no choice. He had to do things by the book. He had to go and see Benton. After wiping the floor with him for wasting time and resources, an approach that he particularly resented as it came from someone who looked young enough to be his daughter, and in terms of years of experience on the job was practically a fetus in comparison to him, Benton finally agreed to authorize a warrant. She wanted the case closed, she wanted it off her desk, and she wanted his head on a plate if it didn't happen soon. By the time he got out of her office, all Ratcliffe wanted was a cup of tea, a good rant, and a change of career. While waiting for the warrant to come through, he fantasized about winning the lottery and telling Benton exactly where she could shove her bright, shiny, fast-track degree. The image in his head involved a distinct lack of sunshine and an unmentionable act involving a certain orifice. By the time he'd finished his tea, he felt better. Much better. Chapter 22. Charlie had slept badly. His neck was stiff and his back crunched like it was made of gravel when he tried to move. Amy was still curled up comfortably in the double bed, emitting gentle, girlish snores. Charlie had spent the night wedged into a small tub chair, with his feet up on the bed and only his jacket to cover him. He was getting too old for all this. The clock told him it was time to move the van again. He woke Amy and told her he would be back soon and to meet him in the breakfast room. After moving the van a few spaces and feeding yet more money into a parking meter, he found his phone, switched it on, and dialed his mother's number. She picked up on the third ring.
"Charlie? Is that you?"
She sounded worried, even a bit frightened.
"Yeah, it's me," he said, the full extent of how guilty he felt making him sag against the van. "Look, I'm sorry about what I said yesterday."
"It's all right, love. You had every right to be angry, but you understand why I kept quiet, don't you?"
He guessed he did, but it still irked him that she had believed it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it another time, okay? I found Amy, and before you ask, she's all right, but she went to see Rachel."
He explained that Rachel was in hospital and that Amy had visited her there. He left out the part about being arrested. He'd had enough grief already. She didn't say anything for a moment.
"What about you? Have you seen her?"
"Not yet. I'm going this morning." He heard her take a sharp intake of breath. "I have to tell her, Ma, you know that."
"Think about it, Charlie. She's lived with that knowledge for nigh on 20 years. It ruined her life. She lost you, she lost Amy, she lost everything. How do you think she's going to take it? It could tip her over the edge. Imagine what it would have been like for you if you'd had to live with that knowledge for all that time. It would have driven you mad. Don't you think it would be better to leave things just as they are?
Her words stymied him for a moment. He had been so clear about her need to hear the truth, about his need to set things straight. Maybe his mother had a point. He knew from personal experience the damage that could be done by a lie. He had spent 10 years in prison as an innocent man over lies. How much worse would it have been if he'd have spent those years thinking he had committed a crime, enduring the knowledge of it, and then had found out it had all been a mistake? His mother was right. He would have gone out of his mind. Would the truth make Rachel's life easier or worse?
Okay, Ma, I take your point. I'll think on it. We'll be home later. Oh, by the way, would you clean up the mess in the house? I don't want Amy to feel bad when she gets home.
Okay, love, I will. Be careful, won't you? Don't do anything stupid.
Charlie took a walk around the block. He needed to think. Last night, when he'd been trying to get off to sleep in that damned chair, he had indulged himself in some vague fantasy that once he told Rachel the truth, everything would be all right.
And we would all live happily ever after, he said aloud, to the surprise of a passing jogger, who gave him a wary look and an extra-wide berth.
Perhaps the kindest thing to do would be to leave Rachel alone. If he saw her at all, he could tell her that it was over, that he wouldn't ever bother her again. Perhaps she would find more peace in that. Perhaps it was his turn to carry the load and protect her. Though the thought of it made his heart feel hollow. Over breakfast, he tried to explain it to Amy.
You are joking, right?
She said aghast, a piece of toast half buttered in her hand.
You can't do that. You have to tell her the truth.
Charlie propped his head in his hands to contain his frustration.
You've seen the state of her, how she lives because of this. What if she can't take it? What if it's the final straw?
And what about the truth setting you free?
Amy argued, the toast still suspended mid-air.
Do you really think it's up to you to choose who gets to know the truth and who doesn't? Isn't that playing God?
I'm only trying to protect her from more harm, Amy.
Yeah, and that's what she thought she was doing for you. Look where it got her. And you, for that matter.
What do you mean? He said, taking his head out of his hands.
Well, it's like 20 years ago someone hit the pause button on both your lives. You've both spent all this time going through the motions, neither of you actually living. You just exist. All because of that terrible lie. You don't have a choice. You have to tell her, Amy said, waving her toast as if it were the gavel that would decide the matter.
When did you get to be so wise? He asked, amused.
I watch a lot of old Dr. Phil, she said with a cheeky smile.
Seriously, though, she has to know. If you don't tell her, I will, she threatened, pointing at him with the toast.
Charlie threw his hands up. Okay, okay, I get it, I'll tell her. But he didn't have a clue how. Now, will you please do something with that bloody toast before you have my eye out?
He smiled as he said it, but he was faking. There was nothing to smile about. They walked to the hospital. Amy had agreed to wait in reception and sit tight while he saw Rachel. She told him to take his time and kissed him on the cheek for luck. He wished he had her conviction that he was doing the right thing. Amy had told him which room to go to, but when he reached it, the bed was empty and freshly made. He went to the nurse's station and asked for Rachel, irritated that the woman behind the desk didn't even look up at him when he spoke.
"Rachel Porter?" "Oh, she discharged herself last night," the woman said, continuing to tap away at her keyboard.
"Pardon?" Charlie said.
"She discharged herself. She's not here. Now, if you don't mind..."
He did mind. He minded a lot. So much so that she threatened to call security if he didn't calm down. He calmed down and asked to speak to a doctor. The woman grudgingly paged the senior house officer, who grudgingly arrived 20 minutes later, and equally grudgingly repeated what Charlie already knew. Rachel had discharged herself against medical advice. He knew the extent of her injuries since the police had taken great delight in describing them in graphic detail when they had believed he had inflicted them. Charlie couldn't believe she would do something so stupid. Then again, she was a woman who believed she had married her own father and given birth to her sister. Hardly the recipe for a strong streak of self-preservation. He ran down the stairs, too impatient to wait for the lift. He was puffed out when he reached the bottom. As he approached Amy, she looked up at him, her expression hopeful.
"How did it go? Is she okay?"
"She's gone," he said breathlessly, bending forward, hands on his knees to support the effort of getting his words out. "She discharged herself last night." Amy was horrified. She had seen the state that Rachel was in.
"Oh my God, we have to find her. Make her come back."
Charlie nodded, dragging air into his lungs as if he could store it up. Given the reception he'd got from the downstairs neighbor the night before, Charlie decided to loiter around the corner while Amy went up to the house. She had agreed to ring him once she got inside the building, so she could let him in without the old biddy calling the police again. When Amy finally rang, he was practically at the door before he could answer, but her words halted him instantly.
"She's not here, she's gone. She got into a taxi about an hour ago with a bag. The old lady doesn't know where, but she said she looked really ill. What are we going to do?"
Charlie didn't have a clue.
Chapter 23. Stella was curled up on her hard bunk, her back to the door. She had been staring for a long time at a small sample of graffiti that someone had managed to carve into the wall, with some implement of destruction that the custody sergeant had missed. Someone had left those words for her, she was sure. It was a message, just like the others. For some time now there had been signs, small communications from a higher power. Even here in the police station they were everywhere. Yesterday, when they had led her down the corridor to her cell, there had been a message written on the floor, disguised as a pattern in the tiles. SOS in Morse code, 3 dots, 3 dashes, 3 dots repeatedly. As she had walked, the floor had spoken to her. Yesterday the floor had said, "Save our souls." Today the wall said, "Peccavi, peccavisti." "I have sinned, you have sinned." It was literally the writing on the wall, the final instruction indicating a course of action that had been spelling itself out for months now. As she finally figured it out, she heard a sigh of relief from outside the door. They must be pleased that she finally had it right. This was confirmed for her a short time later, when the cell door opened and she was told that she was free to go. All those months trying to decipher the meaning of the messages, the days of consternation when she had consistently had it wrong, the derision hissed in her ear for her failure. The presenter on the local evening news had been the most aggressive, staring straight at her every night as her colleague delivered the daily epistle, turning away in disgust when Stella just hadn't understood. How tired they must have been of her lacklustre efforts. Of course, they had checked up on her, whispering outside her door at night, sending men to watch her in such paltry disguises. Come to read the meter, indeed, as if a fool would believe that. She had been cautious not to speak too loudly in the hall after that, sure that the spy in uniform, with the obviously faked ID, had used that strange gadget he had brought with him to program the electric meter to record her every word. The pressure had mounted after that, the communication subtle but relentless. Examples were set on a daily basis. In fact, every time she turned on the television, opened a newspaper, or looked at a magazine, someone was trying to show her what she had done and what she had to do about it. Now that she had a solution, she could have kicked herself for being so stupid. It had been happening for years, and she hadn't grasped the message. Shouldn't it have been obvious when the daughter in EastEnders found out that her sister was her mother? Or in that other soap, when a man's wife had killed him for sexually abusing their daughter? It went on day after day. In stories, in magazines, "My husband tried to kill me," "My ordeal at the hands of my mother," "My secret love child." All messages, all for her. Hadn't Jeremy Kyle yelled her sin at her every morning for years now? The newspapers had been battling with her stupidity for months, but they'd worked out that subtlety didn't work with stupid Stella. Finally, they had published her picture to make sure she finally understood. The headline had spelled it out in black and white. "Is this the inconspicuous face of evil?" When the police had found her, she had almost rejoiced. "Yes, I am the inconspicuous face of evil." That's why she had sought out her father, to check with him that she had interpreted the messages correctly. He hadn't made much sense, had refused to know her for a time. Not that she blamed him. Then one day he had looked her square in the face, his eyes clear with recognition, and he had said those words, "Peccavi, peccavisti." Now that she finally understood, everyone was being nice to her. The policewoman who returned her belongings smiled and held the door for her. The man who had told her he was a doctor smiled at her and wished her luck, told her that he would arrange for her to have a check-up with a consultant for the following week. He was pleasant about it, but there was a clear warning there. They would be checking up on her. No room for mistakes this time. After leaving the police station, she had wondered where she should go.
She thought about the flat above the shop, but it wasn't the right place to do what she needed to do. She knew that she was being followed. People were looking at her. Until she took the road that led to the Limes. Then she was alone. No followers, no disapproving whispers. All alone. She knew that this was the right place to go. Home. Everything had already been prepared for her. The police had left signs telling other people not to enter. The house was empty, cleaned of its contents so that there were no distractions for her. She was angry with herself. She should have worked it all out weeks ago. But no matter, she was here now. The sense that everything was finally going to be solved was a balm to soothe her soul. Stella felt peaceful, serene and serendipitous, and very far from stupid. Chapter 24. Diana Lovell had been surprised to find Rachel waiting for her when she got home from the library that day, even more surprised to see the state of the girl. She had dropped her books and lurched forward to catch her just as the expression on Rachel's face had mutated from relief at Diana's arrival to pallid dread as her legs gave way. Diana had managed to get her inside the house and into a chair. She'd wanted to call an ambulance or at least a doctor, but Rachel had insisted and told her she'd just been discharged from hospital the night before, that she had medication but just needed someone to help her out for a few days. Would Diana let her stay? Diana had instantly agreed. There was no way the girl could cope on her own, and Diana knew that there was no one else to look after her. After she had tucked her up under a quilt on the sofa, made sure she had taken her medication and waited with her until she fell asleep, Diana contemplated the nature of their friendship. She had first met Rachel on Blackfriars Bridge, on a cold and foggy February morning 5 years before. Diana had always loved the London of early morning, when the city was magnificent and quiet, its dirty beauty unhampered by the bustle of the day and unsullied by the hordes that swarmed its streets like voracious termites. Just after dawn was the only time Diana could almost guarantee she would not hear a police siren, a scream, or a cacophony of arguing voices. So that was when she walked. The few people she did see on her dawn constitutional she ignored, and they ignored her. They were either too busy getting where they wanted to go, or still too drunk from the night before to be bothered with the niceties of being polite to strangers. At first, she had walked past the girl on the bridge. Though Rachel was 40 now, she'd always been a girl to Diana. Something had drawn her back, as if an invisible thread had caught onto her clothes and halted her progress. She had paused a few feet away and followed the girl's gaze to the water below. "Tempting sometimes, isn't it?" she'd said. "Never quite tempting enough," Rachel had said, taking a step backwards away from the balustrade that edged the bridge. "Did you know that years ago there were people specifically employed to dredge this river for bodies? I've always thought that it must have been a particularly oppressive occupation," Diana had mused. There was something peculiarly compelling about this lost soul. "I was just about to treat myself to a full-fat latte macchiato, my pre-breakfast tipple. Would you care to join me?" Rachel had glanced behind her briefly, as if Diana had been issuing the invitation to someone else. "There's a rather pleasant little cafe just over the bridge in Southwark. It opens early, just me and a few of the more discerning cabbies, usually," she added, as if the extra information would act as some kind of inducement. Rachel had looked at her dubiously. Diana had smiled and flapped her hand. "Oh, ignore the dark color. I'm not trying to save you. Just offering to buy you a cup of coffee. In fact, to be honest with you, I'm having rather a crisis of faith at the moment. God and I aren't seeing eye to eye." "Then I'm the last person you should be talking to," Rachel had said. But she had accompanied her anyway. And over the years, they had become friends of sorts. Diana had developed a great deal of affection for Rachel, mainly because Rachel demanded so little from her, had no questions that demanded answers beyond Diana's knowledge, wanted nothing in exchange for her company. In fact, the request for help and shelter was the first thing Rachel had ever asked for, yet she had given Diana so much, though she would never acknowledge it. That first morning, as they sipped their coffee, Rachel had asked, "Are you a vicar?" Diana had shaken her head. "No, merely a curate. A part-timer, I'm afraid, though I am sometimes trusted to collect the hymn books," she'd quipped. Rachel had given her half a smile. "What about you?" Diana had asked, hoping that it sounded casual. "Me? Oh, I'm nothing much. A bit of a curate's egg, if you like," Rachel had replied, with the other half of the smile. "I'm all bad, but you'll be too polite to say so." Diana had never found out which bit of Rachel was bad.
She'd had to assume that it must mean the epilepsy, but knew that it was not. Rachel held a belief that she was inherently bad, but always refused to explain her conviction. The girl was not a talker, and that was part of her appeal. The pieces of her history that Diana had managed to glean had been information Rachel had accidentally released in occasional lapses. The rest of Diana's impressions were the prophet